Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the fronts in that war that doesn't get as much attention as it really deserves is in South Asia. And I'm very pleased to say that a man that we had working with us years ago now as an intern at the Center for Security Policy has gone on to much bigger and better things. He is now writing regularly for the Washington Free Beacon and has, in the course of his writings recently, done an extremely important piece about the possibility that there will be a nuclear war in the South Asian region between Pakistan and India. His name is Aaron Kliegman. He is now, as I say, contributing on a whole host of fronts, but this particular piece caught my eye, and I'm so pleased to reconnect with you. Aaron, thank you for joining us here at Secure Freedom Radio. Welcome back.
Thank you very much for having me. Glad to be here.
Well, so it's not news exactly that there's no love lost between Pakistan and India, or that they have nuclear weapons and could, at perhaps a moment's notice, be in conflict again. They fought repeatedly and maybe even a nuclear one. But one of the things that you wrote about was some changes in the sort of force structure of the Indian military in response to a perceived threat of terrorist attack from Pakistan. Of course, the Mumbai attack of a few years ago comes to mind, especially against the backdrop of the similar kind of event in Kenya and Nairobi yesterday. But talk through with us, Aaron, if you would, what the Indians have been doing that seems to be putting a nuclear threshold considerably lower on the subcontinent.
Yes, and I thank you for, I think, raising this important issue, because as I mentioned in the piece I wrote about it, it doesn't get headlines. There's obviously a lot of chaos in the world, but I think this is arguably the most dangerous situation in the world.
No less an authority than Bill Clinton seemed to agree with you some years ago, so you're in good company.
Well, thank you. Essentially, India is working on a military doctrine called Cold Start. It's been in the works for a while. Analysts have debated whether it's going to come to fruition, whether it's actually been sanctioned by the political and military establishments there. And it seems to be recently. Well, first I'll say what the doctrine is based on is if a terrorist attack is launched in India that India believes Pakistan was involved in. And of course, Pakistan, its military and intelligence services have numerous ties to various jihadist groups. But if such an attack is launched, India will, I guess, launch a limited blitzkrieg style operation into Pakistani territory meant to take only a sliver of land and is essentially to use that as leverage in negotiations. The idea is not to do anything that would trigger a nuclear response from Pakistan. Of course, both countries have over 100 nuclear warheads, but that's the plan. And the problem is that Pakistan, well, I guess another problem is that Pakistan has said it will respond to such an act by building more and more low-yield tactical nuclear weapons. India is a much bigger country. It has conventional military superiority. It's always won in four wars since both countries were declared independence in 1947. India has won all four. Pakistan initiated all four. So basically, the point of the tactical nuclear weapons is to control potential escalation, to make India pause and say, wait a minute, we are going to yield. We don't want to go any further down this line. Of course, if a nuclear weapon is used, who knows where the escalation could end from there. So this is an important issue. And I guess I wanted to drive home the point that the military doctrines that these countries are pursuing make a potential nuclear conflict an actual foreseeable event. This isn't some pie in the sky fantasy.
No, and speaking of the doctrine, one of the little noted but very important doctrinal documents of Pakistan is something called the Quranic Concept of War by S.K. Malik. It was written back in 1986. And as you may know, Aaron Kligman, the foreword was written by the then president of Pakistan, Zia. And this was, as a result, regarded, and I think properly so, as an authoritative statement of what the Pakistani, well, as I say, doctrine is. And it was chilling because it made clear that as a, well, Sharia supremacist state, Pakistan believes that crushing the spiritual will of your enemies through terrifying violence is mandated by the Quran, and that that applies to nuclear war as well as conventional war. And against the backdrop of the increasing capabilities of the Pakistanis to wage nuclear war, perhaps with lower yield weapons, as you indicated, lowering the threshold, that Quranic concept of war seems to be something that could be operationalized at any moment.
Yes, and I think that's an important point. When I talk about this escalation that could happen and could potentially end in catastrophe, it's important to remember the initial trigger that would cause this escalation would be a terrorist attack sponsored, tied to in some way Pakistan on India. In other words, India would not have felt a need to put this into action if you didn't have incidents like the 2008 Mumbai terrorist attacks and others. So I think if the way to get to the root of this problem to prevent it from happening is to put pressure on Pakistan to, stop to aiding so many jihadist groups. And I think the Trump administration, this is where they could come in. They've suspended some military aid. I think the problem with that is not that that's uncalled for, but I think it's insufficient. You have countries like Saudi Arabia and China that could give prop up some of that missing aid.
And are.
Yes, exactly. And I think, and especially, I mean, China's investing seriously in Pakistan right now with its Belt and Road Initiative. So I think that the U.S. can do more, consider even no longer considering Pakistan a major non-NATO ally, even calling it calling it a state sponsor of terrorism. I think these should all be on the table because obviously what we've tried hasn't worked. And as I said, Pakistan is, I think, where the real problem is.
I think there's no question about it. It's a problem not just with respect to India, of course, but very much a problem for what we've been trying to do in Afghanistan. And I think its proliferation of nuclear weapons and missiles around the world has been a problem. Needless to say, as you've indicated, its support for terrorism is a problem certainly regionally and arguably around the world. So all of these things taken together argue for, I agree, a very much more robust stance towards Pakistan, and might throw into the mix perhaps encouraging Balochistan separatist elements there as well to focus on the domestic problems of the country rather than some of their external aggression ambitions. We have to leave it at that, Aaron Kligman, for the moment. I'm anxious to talk with you about some of the reporting you've been doing about Venezuela and Iran, and the Taliban, and more. But this will be for another day. We'll look forward to having you back very soon. In the meantime, thanks so much. Keep up the good work at the Washington Free Beacon. We'll talk soon.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We have Dinah West with us, as we do each week, I'm very proud to say. Dinah is one of our most astute observers of, commentators about, and, well, sage thinkers on questions involving where we are as a civilization, as a culture, as a free people. These are the subjects of two superb books she's written. One, Death of the Grown-Up. The other, American Betrayal. You can find her writings these days at dianawest.net. Dinah, welcome back. Good to have you with us. I thought we might start with an issue that is weighing, I think, on both of us, Diana, and should be on all Americans, really, and that is the controversy that is currently swirling in official Washington around remarks made by Congressman Steve King, who I will say right up front has been a friend and admired legislator for me for a long time. It's not to say that everything he's ever said I agree with, nor I'm sure he agreed with everything I've ever said, but I have found him to be a serious champion of freedom, and specifically our constitutional rights and Western civilization more generally. He got caught up in a controversy about some comments he made to the New York Times and has been roundly pilloried for it, stripped of his committee assignments, and now subjected to a House resolution adopted almost unanimously, condemning him. What do you make of what is going on here? I know neither of us have any truck with white supremacism or white nationalism or racism of any kind. And yet, I don't think Steve King does either. And I'd be interested in your takeaway from what's transpired here.
Oh, this is such an important subject. This is one of those moments in Washington where it is just hard to stomach, because we're looking at the public pillorying of a man of integrity. Of course, one does not have to be lockstep with any legislature, but you look for integrity, you look for thoughtfulness, you look for commitment and loyalty to this country and its people. And that's what you see in Steve King, who's been a marvelous legislator in Congress. And we see gotcha journalism, gotcha politics practiced to a terrifying star chamber degree in what has happened in terms of taking an inarticulate, non-parsing sentence without sufficient punctuation, without hearing the voice itself, whereby Steve King's explanation that he was discussing white Western, he was discussing, look, I just did it, he was discussing Western civilization in terms of now being conflated with white nationalism, white supremacism, and essentially targeted for elimination as something to uphold. I mean, this is how serious where we are in terms of the brink. And he was trying to have a conversation with a New York Times reporter, not a good idea, we find, and actually have a real hashing out of political correctness and how terminology goes from having words having meaning to words having political weaponization. And I think that was, you know, a mistake, and he didn't record it himself, a mistake. You'd think someone of his experience would know these things.
For sure, with the New York Times, especially.
Yeah, so we're in the situation where he is left to defend Western civilization, which has now been utterly just rolled over in this resolution by the Republican leadership, which I think is the greatest betrayal of all, and conflated with white supremacism, and he is being accused of having said, when did white supremacism become a bad word? I mean, how ridiculous, how absurd, how insane is that? Doesn't make sense, but it's not about sense. It's about making him an example and making everyone else now afraid to say anything at all about defending the West.
You know, I think there's something else going on here, and this is my theory of the piece, and that is that the Republicans in Congress, particularly the leadership in Congress, made no secret of their desire to be rid of Steve King in the last election cycle. In fact, they went so far as to pull funding from him over some other statement that they found objectionable. And the prospect that he might have become the ranking member of the House Judiciary Committee was such an abhorrent thought to them that I think they were only too willing to throw in with the Democrats, who had their own reasons to want to, as you say, shut down speech of any kind that they find objectionable. And it's not to say that, you know, there is anything to be in favor of, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of advocacy of white supremacism or white nationalism, for that matter. I think there's a lot to be said for advocacy for Western civilization, and most especially our constitutional right as sort of the pinnacle, I think, of Western civilization, our Constitution, to express ourselves freely, even on things that people find objectionable. But as troubling to me as anything, Diana, I have to say, and you and I have talked about this for years, is the country is awash with supremacism at the moment. And it seems as though this particular version of it is being singled out for special criticism and punishments. And I find at least as troubling the supremacists of the Sharia stripe, or for that matter, the Black Lives Matter stripe, or anti-Semites, or anti-Zionists. I mean, these are also very much in evidence, and indeed in the United States Congress to some degree. What's up with this sort of selective outrage about some forms of supremacism and the pass being given to others?
Yes, well, of course, as they used to say in the gruesome 1960s, the issue is never the issue. And once again, we're looking at not people attempting to eliminate hatred and violent intent from the hearts of man, regardless of race, color, creed. We're looking at political hammers being wielded selectively. And once again, we're looking at the complete pass, as we've long observed, of Islamic supremacism or Black supremacism in Black Lives Matter, Antifa, what have you, whereby Sharia is given a pass despite its supremacist intent and anti-constitutional underpinnings and foundations. I mean, these kinds of things are fine because no one is truly interested in liberty and justice for all. They are interested in achieving power. And at this point, the power structure amazingly still remains based in our Constitution, based in our founding, based in the rule of law, such as it is, which is not in a happy state. And so these become emotional and powerfully wielded political cannons, not just hammers, against the structure, against the tradition, against the country itself, and as its founding. And it is all about change. It is all about fundamental transformation, as Obama very openly put it. And this just becomes, the latest in the tactics. And Steve King is sitting there right in the crosshairs, as you very well put it, of both the Republican leadership and, of course, the left. So it was a terrible storm.
Indeed, a perfect storm. Speaking of the rule of law and its parlous state, let me segue to another troubling development, and that is that we had the New York Times this week promoting in some breathless expose the idea that the President of the United States was regarded by the FBI as a Russian agent in the White House shortly after he terminated James Comey as the director of the FBI. When we hear this kind of reporting from the New York Times, I guess it's not a surprise any more than was their political warfare against Steve King, that they've neglected to mention, at least as best I could tell, the cast of characters in the FBI who were doing this. Remind us of that, Diane, if you would, and what their agenda transparently was even well before James Comey was departing.
Well, I mean, the dishonesty of this reveals the New York Times, as if we didn't know, but it reveals the media and the wider media as well, as, again, engaging in power politics, engaging in agitprop. I mean, that's what it is. It's not fake news. It's too cute a term. This is agitprop.
Well, that's a term that we may not be familiar with.
Agitation propaganda.
A Soviet term for using information operations to achieve political ends.
Yes, and this is in this case, this is information warfare against the American people by the Fourth Estate, which is supposed to be essentially protecting our interests by covering and giving us information and saying true things.
Being independent and objective.
And the omissions, I mean, I think one of the more interesting things I ever came up with in reading some of these discussions had to do with omission is often much more important than the actual fake insertions that people can easily come up with or easily disprove. But when you omit facts such as the Andrew McCabe being the one who is involved here, who is currently under indictment or grand jury proceedings, and when you have Christopher Steele not it being explained as having been fired for his double dealings with the FBI as being just presented as this sterling intelligence officer of the British. I mean, you have this kind of presentation of the cast as being honorable, honest brokers doing their job rather than, as we now know, without doubt, operatives of the Hillary Clinton campaign. And we know that because the Steele dossier was funded by the Hillary Clinton campaign and the DNC. So when this is left out, and so much more, I mean, we could go through the entire article.
Well, not least James Baker, one of the senior guys, getting the dope directly from the campaign.
Yes, and working with David Korn, who works for The Nation, the proud winner of the Izzy Award, named for I.F. Stone, a Soviet agent.
Yeah. Ironies of ironies, I think it's fair to say. Diana, we have to leave it at that. There is much more to talk about. Indeed, we're going to continue talking about this topic with Joe DeGeneva in a moment. But I wanted to say thank you, as always, for your contributions to our understanding of politics, but the political warfare, more to the point, that passes for politics in America today. And it's very considerable implications for all of us. Thank you for the work you do at dianawest.net. We'll talk with you next week, my dear. Next up, Joe DeGeneva, former U.S. attorney and one of the country's most robust critics of what is going on by the Department of Justice and FBI. Stay tuned.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It is a great pleasure and high privilege to be able to say we have Joseph DeGeneva in the house, well, virtually at least. Joe is, of course, a former U.S. attorney, former special prosecutor, a practicing attorney in the Washington, D.C. firmament, a fixture at Fox News and in many other outlets where his legal analysis as well as his appreciation of national security are highly sought after, nowhere more so than here. We're always delighted to have him with us. Joe, welcome back. It's so good to have you on board.
And great to be with you, Frank.
We were just talking with Diana West a little bit about this so-called expose by the New York Times, Joe, and the revelations that there were people in the Bureau who were persuaded that Donald Trump, after he sacked James Comey, might be a Russian agent in the Oval Office. Your take on all of that?
Well, the story in the New York Times on Saturday, January the 12th, that the FBI and the DOJ conducted an investigation of Trump after he became president as a possible Russian spy is nothing new. That story was leaked to the New York Times by Comey, Strzok, Page, Baker, Brennan, and Clapper. And the reason is very simple. Because Mueller is not going to find any Russian collusion, they are attempting to set out an old and yet new narrative as to why they did what they did before the election, during transition, and after the election. What they are afraid of is that it has been discovered that there was illegal activity going on for a number of years during the Obama administration involving the illegal searching of NSA databases to go after political rivals. And so they needed to start getting out a counter narrative. And so this thing to dirty up Trump appears on the front page of the New York Times. I'm happy to say that the moment that Bill Barr is confirmed, their lives are going to get terribly, terribly complicated for Mr. Comey and all the other people I just mentioned, because there will be a federal grand jury into criminal violations of the Espionage Act by a number of FBI and DOJ officials. And sad to say, there are at least three former senior Department of Justice Obama administration officials who will be targets of that grand jury.
Wow. Well, we will be staying tuned on that, needless to say, Joe. But am I right that there seemed to be something absent from the Times reporting when they were discussing breathlessly, as I'm fond of saying, this scandal, they claim, namely that the people who were running the FBI at the time had every reason to try to dirty up, as you put it, Donald Trump, and more to the point, try to drive him from office if they could, because they were deeply exposed to a grand jury, you know, a long time ago, perhaps.
Yes, absolutely, Frank. That's what's so staggering about the complicity of the New York Times in this story, because it conflicts with the known record that the Times has already reported. You know, there have been a number of stories that have been put out by the New York Times on behalf of all of these people to explain, for example, when the counterintelligence surveillance case against, quote, the Trump campaign, which means Donald Trump personally, started. In fact, the counterintelligence operation, which was improperly and not authorized, began in the summer or spring of 2016 and continued on. The notion that somehow in 2017, after Comey is fired, they discover that he might be a Russian agent and they start a counterintelligence operation is absolutely ludicrous. The spying on the Trump campaign began in 2016, and that's when the NSA databases were used to spy on the president and his staff. I mean, this story is so remarkably corrupt from a journalistic standpoint. I don't think it survives New York Times versus Sullivan. I mean, it's unbelievable how bad this is.
Yeah. Joe, more generally, maybe you could address a question that arose in a conversation I had recently with a former assistant U.S. attorney, Sidney Powell, about the Mueller investigation's evident obstruction of justice, she says, insofar as the investigation seems to have destroyed the cell phones or the data on the cell phones that were used by Peter Strzok and Lisa Page, and in the process, quite possibly made the kind of prosecution that you're talking about more difficult.
Well, first of all, let's remember what happened here. Strzok and Page are working for Mueller. Mueller finds out from the Inspector General of the Department of Justice that there are text messages between Strzok and Page, which are so biased and prejudiced that they completely threaten Mueller's investigation. Mueller secretly fires them and sends them away, but tells no one until months later, so he can secretly protect his investigation. As a result of that, we learn that the bias in the Bureau was so contemptible and so deep that there's no way they could have conducted any investigation, and that that just was outrageous, not only bias, but animus against Trump, the candidate, and then Trump, the president. So they took their phones that they had been given while working for Mueller, and instead of turning them over to the IG, they put them back into, quote, service, and their contents were erased.
Irrecoverably erased at that, as I understand it.
Yes, we think, but there may be some way to get them, and that is being pursued right now, I am told. But here's the point. If a private company had done what Bob Mueller did, they would be indicted for obstruction of justice in that they destroyed evidence. Now, he may not have known what was on those phones, but because he didn't know, he had a duty to preserve those phones so someone investigating the matter could find out if there was something on there. He didn't do that. That failure was actionable.
And it raises, again, questions that you have perhaps been at the forefront of a growing number of people about the Mueller investigation. You brought up the issue of Bill Barr. Of course, he had his confirmation hearing yesterday before the Senate Judiciary Committee. I know you were monitoring it closely. One of the highlights of it, of course, were commitments that were extracted from him by the Democrats primarily about not interfering with the Mueller investigation. But talk us through what you made more generally of his appearance. And you seem to think he will be confirmed, but your anticipation of whether there's likely to be any particular skullduggery between this moment and that.
Well, I heard a lot of conservatives complaining last night that he gave assurances that bothered them greatly. My answer to them is, where are you going to go, Ghostbusters? I mean, the truth is, Bill Barr is a superb professional. He follows on the heels of a horrendous attorney general, Jeff Sessions, and an evil Rasputin-like creature, Rod Rosenstein, who sits there, you know, astride the department still at this point. Rosenstein will be gone shortly after Barr takes office. I have every expectation that Bill Barr, who I've known for over 30 years, we're not close friends, but we are professional friends. I respect him. I respect his judgment. The fact that he knows Bob Mueller doesn't bother me because he can tell Bob to go to hell because he knows him as well. I don't believe that Bill Barr is going to do anything but the right thing. I started out feeling that way about Bob Mueller. I became increasingly distressed over Bob's behavior and the behavior of his Democratic people that he hired to conduct the investigation. The point is, we are where we are. We have to hope for the best. The evidence of criminality involving the 2016 election, criminality by Obama, FBI, and DOJ officials, is stark. It's unavoidable. I do not expect Bill Barr to ignore it. I expect him to make sure that it is thoroughly investigated, and I expect people to be charged.
I hope you're right. From your lips to God's ears, as they say, Joe DiGenova. Let me close with a question that I suspect is near and dear to your heart as well. There has been a campaign of late on the part of Democratic members of the Senate Judiciary Committee to, well, how to put it, challenge, impugn, or otherwise suggest that it is disqualifying for judicial appointments or executive branch officials, for that matter, in the Justice Department to be Roman Catholics. What are your thoughts on that? And did this feature at all in the hearing yesterday with Bill Barr, who happens to be one?
Well, the war on Catholics through the war on the Knights of Columbus by the Democrats on the Judiciary Committee is a fascinating display of the type of politics that the modern Democratic Party practices. I can just see Scoop Jackson rolling over in his graves as he watched the lowlifes like Dick Durbin, Kamala Harris, crazy Mazie Hirono try to impugn the integrity of the men of the Knights of Columbus, a huge charitable organization connected to the Catholic Church. Members in the past have included John F. Kennedy, Ted Kennedy, Bill Barr, who is a member of the Knights of Columbus. The Democrats seem intent on making abortion the only issue they care about. Because of the Knights of Columbus have adopted the position of the Catholic Church, of which they are an adjunct, that they oppose abortion, Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee believe that they are evil, and that anybody associated with the Knights of Columbus is therefore an evil person. The stupidity of Mazie Hirono becomes apparent every day as you watch her on television making a fool of herself and her party. I pray to the Lord that the Democrats continue to put her out publicly so the American people can see a truly ignorant member of the United States Senate.
Joe, we have to leave it at that. I thank you so much for your time, as always, for the great work that you do in clarifying the legal and particularly the national security implications of the legal issues you're following. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined by the inimitable Elaine Donnelly. Elaine is the president, the founder, the driving force behind an indispensable organization. It's called the Center for Military Readiness. She has, through its work, done more than just about anybody, certainly in civilian life that I know of, to help illuminate, clarify, and really raise alarms about what is being done to the culture of the military, such an incredibly important and yet little understood ingredient in having a military that is combat ready and has the morale and the wherewithal, more generally, to do what we require of it to defend the rest of us. Elaine has served in other capacities as well as an advisor to the Pentagon, on a presidential commission, and is just our go-to resource on matters involving the kind of social engineering, particularly, that has done such harm to the military. And Elaine, I thought of you immediately when I saw a superb article by Heather McDonald recently in the Wall Street Journal talking about the inadvisability of women in combat. You've been talking about, warning about that for years. Give us a sort of précis of Heather's argument and your own, and sort of a sense of where things stand on that front.
Thank you for the kind words, Frank. Yes, Heather McDonald's article in the Wall Street Journal, I'm sure, dropped like a bomb in the Pentagon. It was the clarity of it and the straightforward call for the next Secretary of Defense to reassess everything to do with women in the military, women in the infantry. The entire social experiment has not been working out. Despite promises that were made, standards have been adjusted and changed to accommodate gender integration. And it's the kind of thing that is harmful to the military. So the next Secretary of Defense should stop the social experiment. He should reassess everything that's happened so far. And we just posted a new article just this morning taking issue with the Marine Corps Commandant, General Robert Neller, because he caved on the issue of co-ed basic training, a very controversial and related issue to women in combat, one that only a few years ago he was irate and infuriated when the previous Secretary of the Navy, Ray Mabus, issued an order to gender integrate boot camp at Parris Island. He was outraged. Now, here we have the same general, the same commandant, ordering the same thing quietly on a Friday afternoon, hoping no one would notice. I mean, there is absolutely no excuse for what is happening here. And yet it's just sort of drifting forward on, you know, inertia. All the social experiments and engineering that's been going on, somebody needs to put a stop to it.
Well, and this is the point, isn't it, that we've been sort of induced to believe there's an irreversibility to these decisions, whether it's women in combat, whether it's women integration into basic training, whether it's the standards being adjusted downward to assure their success in what physiologically they may simply not otherwise be able to do in terms of performance. And then, of course, there's the whole transgender issue, which, of course, you've been very intimately involved in as well. Much of this was allowed to, as you say, sort of drift along under the previous Secretary of Defense, James Mattis. Talk a little bit about, again, how these various elements are impacting the military, as we're now seeing, I suspect, among other things, in terms of reduced ability to recruit.
Yes, the stronger economy makes it harder for recruiters to do their job. This is a matter of great concern. But if that's the problem, the answer is not putting women in the infantry and adjusting standards so that they are less challenging for men and cause more injuries among women. And the reason that General Neller, or the excuse given, and it's a very lame excuse, the reason they're putting one platoon of female recruits into a training battalion with five male platoons, they're going to mix them all up in one training battalion. The reason they gave for this was, well, we only have one platoon of women, so we're going to kind of bundle them all together, and we won't have to have a separate female training battalion. Well, this makes no sense at all. Yeah, you have fewer female recruits in general in the winter months, but you don't make decisions based on the weather. It's the needs of the service, and you send people to boot camp based on the needs of the service. So when they said, oh, it's only temporary, well, that doesn't hold up either, because the previous services made a conscious decision not to evaluate the results of co-ed basic training. The Marines, when they were ordered by the previous Secretary of Defense to put women in the infantry.
This would be Ash Carter initially?
That's right. Ashton Carter ordered this over the objections of the Marine Corps, and the Marines had solid evidence behind them that this would make the direct ground combat units slower, more prone to injuries, less effective.
They'd rigorously studied this, unlike some of the other services.
3 years. Scientific study, documented, University of Pittsburgh.
Partly why, presumably, the then commandant of the Marine Corps, General Dunford, now the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was so adamant in opposing this.
That is right. And his request was, of course, brushed aside. And even the reasons why he made that request, they buried that information. It's been stuffed down the memory hole. And it's most unfortunate. That information needs to be brought to light. And we need to reassess women in the infantry. The experiment is not going well. We need to look at the compromises in training that we know have already occurred. And under the current commandant, General Neller, this is important because a new commandant will be coming in this year, and the president needs to choose wisely. And the Secretary of Defense needs to be chosen, who has the courage, just like Heather McDonald, to say very clearly, the experiments need to stop. They need to be ended. There's more than enough reason. And in the article we just posted, we've taken an historic approach. We're looking at co-ed basic training over the last 25 years. It started with Sarah Lister many years ago when she called the Marines extremist. The uproar ensued, but she got her way. She got co-ed basic training in the Army. Then you started seeing sex scandals at Aberdeen Proving Ground, Fort Leonard Wood, and other basic training bases. Fast forward to Iraq. Here comes Abu Ghraib. How did that kind of indiscipline, that repugnant scandal, how could that happen? Well, it had its roots in basic training, if you look at the historic perspective here. All of these things need to be reassessed. Even only a year ago, the Commandant of the Marine Corps, looking at the infantry officer course at Quantico, Virginia, he changed the combat endurance test instead of a pass-fail requirement on the first day. He made it only a data point. Well, you can take the test, but if you don't succeed, that's okay. You can still pass the infantry officer course. Well, that enabled a second woman to pass.
Yeah, so talk about what it means in real-world terms to have people who can't make the cut otherwise make it through on the basis of relaxed or diminished standards.
That's right. We have a very, very tough course, the infantry officer course, to teach and find young men who can lead other men into battle. That's it. That's the only mission. And you have to separate the best from the rest. If you change that standard and make success optional, you are implementing a sociological goal. The Marines have a 10% quota for females in the military. This is corrupting everything. The other services have even higher quotas, 25%. In the Navy and the Army and the Air Force. These quotas, that's the first thing that President Trump should do. Get rid of the gender quotas. Electors will take an honest look at the consequences of social engineering in all of these different areas. And a commandant of the Marine Corps will fix the damage done by the current commandant.
Amen. Let me ask you to go back, Elaine Donnelly, though, to something we talked about a moment ago. If women are going to be reduced in, you know, eliminating such quotas, won't that the recruitment problem that the military currently has? And isn't that one of the principal arguments that we all know we have to have women in the military because we can't get enough men?
Well, here's the flaw in that argument. Recruiters have to spend a lot more time trying to meet those gender quotas. They have to make many more calls. They have to spend a lot more time trying to persuade women to join the military. And it's probably worse now. We need to find out, why are there not enough women going in that recruit battalion? I mean, maybe that is making the problem worse, not better.
It could indeed. We have to leave it at that. Elaine Donnelly, as always, so much food for thought and so much important thought needs to be given to what we're doing to the United States military at a time when, unfortunately, it looks as though it's going to be more needed than ever to protect us in an increasingly dangerous world. We appreciate so much what you do at the Center for Military Readiness. Come back to us again soon, Elaine. In the meantime, I know you'll keep up the great work. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.